currently have felony bans on health care pending. So if those bills pass in Alabama, there's one vote left in the House. In Idaho, it has to make it to the Senate. These are bills that also would be similarly catastrophic for trans people. And we already have such a bill that thankfully we enjoined in Arkansas, but our litigation continues there. And of course, there's dozens of bills across the country still pending.
And specifically in Idaho, what you are most concerned about happening there?
You know, I'm concerned that this bill passes and all care is cut off. And not only is it cut off, that bill would make it a felony with potential life imprisonment, not only to treat people in state, but to take someone out of state to get the treatment. What are families supposed to do? And as a parent, I simply cannot imagine what it must feel like to face criminal prosecution to try to keep your kid alive.
And how many bills like this have been introduced around the country, Chase?
We are facing a context now where over 35 states have introduced bills targeting transgender young people. Thankfully, we are able to stop some of them, but we are continuing to fight to the very end of these legislative sessions because there is an aggressive push to move these quickly through state legislatures.
Well, we want to get into the details of these, so we're going to do part two of our discussion with you right now. Chase Strangio, Deputy Director for Trans Justice with the ACLU, LGBTQ, and HIV Project. That does it for our show, Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for Human Resources Manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Messiah Rhodes, Noreen Sheikh, Maria Terracena. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. If you're able, please go to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution in support of the critical work of community radio. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 37th annual Sing Time Weekend Retreat of Portland Folk Music Society from 6 p.m. March 25th until noon on March 27th at the Minucha Conference Center in Corbett. Sing Time features workshops, song circles, concerts, and lots of singing and jamming in a residential setting. A scholarship fund is available and vaccinations and masks are required. Again, that's Portland Folk Music Society's Sing Time Weekend Retreat, starting at 6 p.m. on Friday, March 25th at the Minucha Conference Center, 38711 E Historic Columbia River Highway in Corbett. More information can be found at portlandfolkmusic.org/singtime.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the head of the Oregon Republican Party resigns in a leaked letter. The Florida legislature passes the so-called Don't Say Gay bill. And in international news, Russia bombs a Ukrainian hospital. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 9th, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. In Ukraine, Russia's promised safe evacuation corridors have yet to materialize. Meanwhile, the shelling of major cities continues, including the port of Mariupol, where Ukraine has accused Russian forces of, quote, holding 400,000 people hostage, end quote. In that city, workers are trying to rescue infants from the rubble of a bomb maternity hospital. The assault on Kyiv continues to be stalled by supply issues. So far, over 2.2 million Ukrainians have fled their country. Just today, Ukraine's government banned exports of rye, barley, buckwheat, millet, sugar, salt, and meat until the end of this year, which will impact food supplies and prices in Europe and beyond. The economic sanctions on Russia continue to build, with more U.S. and European companies halting business. The inflation rate in Russia rose 2% in just 1 week. Concerns grow about Russia defaulting on its sovereign debt as the value of the Russian ruble continues to tank. The ruble is currently worth less than a penny. Vice President Kamala Harris' trip to Romania and Poland took on more significance after a Polish proposal to send some old Russian fighter jets to Ukraine via a U.S. airbase in Germany. That proposal has been rejected by the Biden administration. Intelligence suggests that Vladimir Putin could double down on his invasion of Ukraine. With that story and more, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I'm thinking about the women in Ukraine fighting to keep their country free, and those holding their children, you know, holding them close as they flee to safety.
On International Women's Day, First Lady Jill Biden offered support for Ukrainian women, as well as women in Russia and other nations who speak up against oppression. Congressional leaders received an update from top intelligence agencies on Russia's invasion of Ukraine. CIA Director William Burns described Vladimir Putin as isolated and indignant.
I think Putin is angry and frustrated right now. He's likely to double down and try to grind down the Ukrainian military with no regard for civilian casualties.
Officials also suspect Putin remains confident that Russia can defeat Ukraine despite facing more resistance than expected. The Pentagon rejected a proposal from Poland to transfer fighter jets to the U.S. for delivery to Ukraine. Spokesman noted the plan's difficult logistical challenges, as well as threats made by Russia regarding arms being provided to Ukrainians to use against its forces. President Joe Biden announced a ban on all Russian oil, gas, and energy imports. While acknowledging the move will lead record high gas prices to climb even higher, Biden also said steps are being taken to ensure the reliable supply of global energy.
It's simply not true that my administration or policies are holding back domestic energy production. That's simply not true.
Republicans who supported the plan also called for increases in domestic energy production.
We should replace it with American oil, not Saudi oil, not Iranian oil, not Venezuelan oil.
That's Senator Marco Rubio of Florida. The average price for a gallon of regular gas hit $4.14 on Monday. Congressional leaders reached a deal to provide $14 billion in aid to Ukraine. The money will be included in a massive government funding package needed to prevent a government shutdown on Friday. Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson is making the rounds on Capitol Hill, meeting Tuesday with Senate Judiciary Committee member Mazie Hirono. The senator from Hawaii said she's hopeful Republicans keep an open mind about Jackson's willingness to work with others.
One of her strengths would be her willingness and desire to listen to the perspectives of the other justices, and at the same time to be very clear on what her positions should be.
Jackson also met with Republicans Rick Scott of Florida and Susan Collins of Maine. Today she'll speak with West Virginia moderate Joe Manchin, who holds a pivotal vote in the 50-50 split chamber. A Biden administration attorney urged the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals to reinstate the COVID-19 vaccination mandate for federal employees, arguing the directive is within the president's capacity. The ruling was put on hold by a lower court judge earlier this year after a legal challenge from federal workers. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The chair of the Oregon Republican Party resigned in a letter blaming, quote, communist psychological warfare tactics, end quote. Dallas Hurd is a conservative state senator from Myrtle Creek. He'll keep his seat, but no longer chair the state Republican Party. Hurd said that the, quote, communist psychological warfare tactics, end quote, were coming from his own party, and that it became too much for him. The letter was leaked by an anonymous source. In it, Hurd tells party members to, quote, guard their hearts against the wickedness in our party, end quote, and stressing the importance of beating the, quote, godless left, end quote, in November. Senator Hurd has been relatively absent from the recent 2022 short legislative session after being kicked out of the state capitol for not wearing a mask. The redistricting process is complete in Oregon, which means many Oregonians could have new representatives after the 2022 elections. The new voting maps have received criticism for how lawmakers drew them. Eric Tegetoff has more on the new maps and their impact.
The congressional and legislative voting maps are drawn in Oregon, and that could mean changes for Oregon voters in the 2022 elections. Oregonians can find the new lines for congressional and state House and Senate districts on the Oregon Legislature's website. Norman Turrell with the League of Women Voters of Oregon says shifts in the lines could mean new faces will represent them in 2023.
The effect on each voter will be quite dramatic, perhaps, because they'll get new representatives in the new election they're not familiar with.
Turrell says voting precincts still are being adjusted at the county level. The state's growing population means Oregon added a sixth seat in the U.S. House of Representatives after the 2020 census. Officials voted in based on the newly drawn maps will take office in 2023. There has been criticism about how the state's maps were drawn. The Princeton Gerrymandering Project gave Oregon's congressional map a failing grade for its lack of competitive races. It says the maps instead protect incumbent Democrats and essentially ensure the party will control five of the six seats. Turrell says the legislative maps are similarly partisan and agrees this type of gerrymandering is bad for Oregonians.
The effect for the voters is that they're going to have less opportunity to change their representation, and the representation in Congress and the legislature will not be proportional to the number of voters in each category.
Turrell is also chair of the group People Not Politicians, which supports a constitutional amendment that would create an independent commission for redistricting rather than allowing state lawmakers to create maps. The initiative is waiting a state Supreme Court ruling to see if it can collect signatures to qualify for the November ballot. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Republican state senators in Florida yesterday passed the so-called Don't Say Gay or Trans bill, which Governor Ron DeSantis is expected to sign. The bill bans public school teachers from instruction about sexual orientation and gender identity from kindergarten through third grade, though such subjects are not taught in those grades, or at any level that is not age-appropriate, which the bill does not define. The bill also empowers parents to sue schools that fail to comply with its vague terms. The approval came despite statewide protests by students and supporters, including classroom walkouts last week and a rally at the state capitol on Monday. ACLU of Florida Legislative Director Kara Gross wrote, quote, "With this bill, politicians have essentially silenced teachers and students from speaking and learning about LGBTQ plus siblings, family members, friends, neighbors, and icons," end quote. Last week, Christina Pushaw, the governor's press secretary, suggested in a tweet that opponents of the measure are pedophiles or support pedophilia. In the wake of the Florida legislature passing the Don't Say Gay bill, LGBTQ plus lawmakers, allies, and advocates send strong messages of support to LGBT youth. Trimal Gomes has the story.
LGBTQ advocates are turning their focus to encouraging words for young people who are gay, following passage of Florida's Parental Rights in Education bill. Dubbed the Don't Say Gay bill by critics, it would limit what is taught about sexual orientation and gender identity in classrooms and ban it in kindergarten through grade 3, or in a manner that is not age-appropriate or developmentally appropriate for students in accordance with state standards. Democratic Senator Chevron Jones, who is openly gay, has shared emotional testimony against the bill. Knowing it was about to pass, he turned attention to those affected.
I want to speak to the boy or girl, the trans boy or the trans girl. I want to tell them that you're wonderful, you're not confused, and there's a community of people who love you, who support you, and who are rooting for you.
Proponents argue certain topics should be left up to parents. The bill would also allow parents to sue schools or teachers that engage with these topics. Governor Ron DeSantis has indicated his support, and if it is signed into law, it would go into effect July 1st. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention and Department of Health and Human Services, LGBTQ youth are more likely to attempt suicide than non-LGBTQ teens. Democratic Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith, an openly gay lawmaker, calls it disingenuous for the bill's sponsor to claim it's about parental rights.
Governor DeSantis's own press secretary used the Don't Say Gay bill this weekend to accuse opponents of the legislation of pedophilia, which is a despicable and disgusting attack on our community.
Bill sponsor GOP State Representative Joe Harding says it would not prohibit people from discussing gender identity or sexual orientation in classrooms, but would ban curriculum and lessons on these topics. The Biden administration has denounced the legislation. This is Tramel Gomes for Florida News Connection. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
Two Portland teenagers died this week from taking pills laced with fentanyl. Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid that is 80 to 100 times more potent than morphine. Police said both teens had blue pills in their possession and investigators suspect they may have thought they were OxyContin or Xanax. The Portland Police Bureau said they released the preliminary information to prevent another overdose. They are trying to track down the source of the pills. Portland Public Schools sent a flyer to families discussing the dangers of taking fentanyl and of counterfeit pills. It said one pill can kill. Officials say any student who comes forward to talk about substance abuse can get help without facing disciplinary action. The flyer also read, quote, "The best prevention is talking to your student about never taking any medication that doesn't come from their doctor. This is a conversation that can literally save your child's life," end quote. The Moda Center will stop requiring face masks or coronavirus vaccinations starting Saturday, March 12th. That goes for elsewhere on the Rose Quarter campus as well. Rose Quarter and Trailblazers officials made the announcement Tuesday. The new rules go into effect after the last day of Oregon's statewide indoor mask mandate, Friday, March 11th. The Oregon Health Authority still recommends masking for those at high risk. Officials also continue to recommend vaccination to reduce risk of severe illness from COVID-19. Individual performers and event organizers may still have COVID policies in place for ticket holders. Attendees are advised to check their tickets or go to rosequarter.com for details. The vaccine requirement includes Blazers and Winterhawks games and concerts. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. In honor of Women's History Month, we'll hear the documentary She's Beautiful When She's Angry, a reflection on the rise of the women's liberation movement in the United States. At 6, it's Rhythm Nation with Peter Marks. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 32. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with a high of 48. Today in history, in 2011, the Space Shuttle Discovery makes its final landing after making 39 flights. The quote of the day is from French novelist Stéphane Audigai, who said, quote, "What we call time isn't chronological, but spatial. What we call death is merely a transition between different types of matter," end quote. Federal government will explore whether to create its own cryptocurrency. President Biden signed an executive order today that directs the Federal Reserve to explore whether the central bank should create its own digital currency. The order also directs the Treasury Department and other federal agencies to study the impact of cryptocurrency on financial stability and national security. This is the first comprehensive federal digital asset strategy in the United States. A joint statement from Biden's top economic and national security advisors said, quote, "That will help position the U.S. to keep playing a leading role in the innovation and governance of the digital assets ecosystem at home and abroad in a way that protects consumers, is consistent with our democratic values, and advances U.S. global competitiveness," end quote. Administration officials are increasingly concerned that Russia may be using cryptocurrency to avoid the effect of sanctions imposed because of its invasion of Ukraine. Democratic leaders have already asked the Treasury Department to provide information on how it plans to inhibit cryptocurrency use to evade those sanctions. But the Biden administration does not believe crypto is a true sanctioned workaround. Some 40 million Americans have invested in cryptocurrencies. Officials have already said a digital currency would best serve the needs of the country by having banks or payment firms create accounts or digital wallets. More than 100 countries are interested in developing their own digital sovereign currency, according to the White House. Some experts advise caution. Hillary Allen is a financial regulation professor at American University. She warned against moving too fast to embrace cryptocurrencies. She said, quote, "I think crypto is a place where we should be putting the brakes on this innovation until it's better understood. As crypto becomes more integrated into our financial system, it creates vulnerabilities, not just to those who are investing in crypto, but for everybody who participates in our economy," end quote. The Treasury Department's financial literacy arm will work to develop consumer-friendly materials to help Americans make informed choices about digital assets. For the first time in more than 50 years, Minneapolis teachers went on strike on Tuesday. Backers of the educators on the picket line says it goes beyond just their demands. The movement reflects the morale of teachers nationwide. Mike Moen has more.
Teachers in Minneapolis walked the picket line Tuesday in hopes of securing better pay and more mental health support in schools. Their calls echo the sentiment shared by educators elsewhere. Other demands from Minneapolis teachers include smaller class sizes and culturally relevant support for staff members. Matt Pulowski, who serves as a teacher mentor in the district, says educators have made huge sacrifices to meet the needs of students during the pandemic.
It's been a rough ride. We are fighting for a better future so that our morale can improve.
Educators say the district has the resources to meet their demands, but the superintendent has cited lower enrollment and inadequate education funding as roadblocks. St. Paul avoided its own teacher walkout this week with a last-minute agreement. The labor issues have spurred calls for state lawmakers to use Minnesota's large budget surplus to boost school funding. GOP leaders say the focus should be on taxpayer relief. Nationally, teachers' advocates hope the events in Minneapolis renew a groundswell of calls for action, like the Red for Ed walkouts in districts across the country a few years ago. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten was in the city Tuesday, suggesting the stress is felt on a broader level.
There are 16,000 school districts in this country. Kids and parents and educators have been through it in a way that is unprecedented.
The Minneapolis labor dispute also highlights calls for better pay, not just for teachers, but for educational support professionals. Pulaski says with many of these individuals making only $24,000 a year, it's hard to deliver a robust system that helps students thrive.
And so if we had wages that attracted and retained educators, ESPs, and teachers here in Minneapolis, we would have the schools that our kids deserve.
Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
Some of the squeeze on the U.S. Postal Service's finances will be coming to an end this week. The Postal Service Reform Act is on its way for President Biden's signature, with the Senate voting 79-19 in approval. The bill ends a decades-long mandate for the Postal Service to pre-fund medical and retirement benefits for the next 75 years, which seriously hindered their finances. The bill will spend $107 billion on an overhaul of the Postal Service, including new features. A new online tracking system will be created to give customers a better idea on when expected mail will arrive. Saturday mail service is guaranteed to continue, and no services will be privatized. National Association of Letter Carriers President Frederick Rolando said, quote, "This is a monumental victory for letter carriers and all Americans who depend on the Postal Service for affordable and high-quality universal service," end quote. Controversial Postmaster General Louis DeJoy even supported the bill. He is currently being criticized for plans to purchase new gas-guzzling delivery trucks in spite of President Biden's proposed transition to zero-emission government vehicles. Tribal leaders recently testified to Congress about the importance of tribal knowledge in land management with the federal government. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders from New Mexico and Colorado were among those to testify Tuesday before the House Natural Resources Committee on Tribal Co-Management of Federal Lands. Leaders from the Zuni and Southern Ute tribes say Native people have deep connections to the land and have long been stewards using their traditional knowledge. Lawmakers heard how the taking of traditional homelands and federal management has impacted sacred areas, including Bears Ears in Utah. Lieutenant Governor Carlton Bawakati of the Pueblo of Zuni is co-chair of the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. He says tribes are eager to work with federal agencies in the management of the sacred area after protections were restored to Bears Ears National Monument by the Biden administration last year. And he says tribes are approaching management from a cultural landscape perspective.
Knowledge of an area that has ancestral ties is important. And when we have that responsibility, we can't let that go. However, the government always treats it as, well, this is a project. Here's this location. How is it affected? When we know that in our approach with the Bears Ears and Tribal Coalition has been really the 1.9 million acres. We understand that in the end, the proclamation states 1.36. However, we are still looking at that as an entire landscape. So those are some of the things that when we're doing our land management planning process, that is what we hope will inform the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service and how we can accomplish that. speaking with the Forest Service and the BLM, they are experts in their processes. However, it's always absent from the tribal point of view.
Bawakati says it's crucial for younger generations to be involved in the management of lands.
Bears Ears landscape and the ancestral ties that we have allowed us to reconnect. And what I mean and I need for our younger generations to understand is that their existence is bigger than the reservation. When we speak to the things that we want for them and the continuance of traditional ecological knowledge, they are the ones that are going to continue it for us. We can want it for them as tribal leaders, but we can't force it down them. They have to want it for themselves. And if they don't want it for themselves, we see the spiritual repercussions they have.
Bawakati says dedicated funding is needed for ongoing co-management efforts. Democratic lawmakers on the committee pledged their support. The hearing was held in two parts and also explored legal support for tribal co-management. First Lady Jill Biden was greeted by tribal leaders and tribal citizens of the Tohono O'odham Nation during a visit to the reservation in Arizona on Tuesday. Her visit, along with Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Javier Becerra, was part of the Biden administration's Cancer Moonshot Initiative, an effort to reduce cancer death rates. The First Lady spoke about the administration's cancer initiative, expressing how it's personal after her son's death from cancer. Here's part of her remarks from local news station KGUN 9.
Joe is totally committed to this. I've been traveling the last couple months all across America to look at what's new in cancer, in research, meet with navigators, look at rural programs, look at programs in the cities. And of course, I would come here and look at programs for Native Americans.
The First Lady and Secretary learned about the tribe's cancer program and services, which includes a partnership with the University of Arizona Cancer Center. The Cancer Center partners with tribal communities across the state on training, research, and outreach programs for Native Americans. In Idaho, the Fort Hall Business Council is requesting the Pocatello School District change its graduation attire policy to allow Native American students to wear cultural and religious items to graduation. School policy prohibits students from wearing eagle feathers or beaded caps to ceremonies. The Shoshone-Bannock tribes wrote a letter to the district, and a Native Parent Education Committee has proposed a draft policy. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is trying to read the signs.
I put a sign out for the re-election of a city councilor. Someone ripped it up. I'd given one to a neighbor whose son, living with her, took it down and said he hated the incumbent. Which of the other candidates did he support, I asked. He didn't know of any of them. Who else is out there to challenge the police and their mayor? As gas prices near $5, though that gas was pumped and refined months before the Ukraine war. Since the Ukrainian breadbasket isn't being planted this spring, expect your next grocery bill to rocket. If the Ukrainian people's resistance, if the economic sanctions and not being able to get a Big Mac turn Putin into a wounded, cornered animal with an army of hackers and nuclear weapons? And what about us at American street level, swelling our debt in frustration because of short supplies and higher prices created in the corporate suites, unable to afford a corner to cringe in, fueled by the media to lash out for justice when all we can reach is one another? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
A steel mill in Pueblo, Colorado has switched to renewable energy to reduce its climate impact. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. A steel plant in Pueblo, Colorado is using the power of the sun to turn recycled scrap metal into train rails.
Colorado is known for several things. One is sunshine. So it was really just an ideal place for a solar farm and just made a lot of sense.
David Ferryman is with the Pueblo unit of Evraz North America, the company that owns the plant. He says globally, most steel is made in big, high-temperature blast furnaces using iron ore and coal. That process generates a huge amount of carbon pollution, which increases global warming. But in the U.S., the majority of steel is made from recycled scrap metal. That process can be powered by more efficient electric furnaces.
From an environmental perspective, there's much less carbon produced in electric arc furnaces versus blast furnaces.
But the process still uses a lot of electricity, which typically comes from burning fossil fuels. So to reduce its climate impact, the Pueblo facility is turned to renewables. An on-site solar farm will now offset about 90% of the plant's electricity use. So it's demonstrating one path toward a greener future for steel. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 9th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and myself, Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegetoff, Mary Sherman, Timrell Gomes, Mike Moan, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.